This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
Number 116, in the matter of application of Paul L. Gault, et al., appellant.
Mr. Dorson.
This case raises important constitutional questions concerning the extent to which requirements of procedural fairness guaranteed by the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment are applicable to juvenile proceedings. Appellants, the parents of Gerald Francis Gault, claim in particular that the Arizona Juvenile Code, on its face and as applied in this case, is invalid and failing to provide basic protections.
The opening of proceedings in the United States Supreme Court in 1966, during which the court decided that when they face prosecution, children have the same basic rights in America's courtrooms as adults. That decision was handed down on May 15, 1967, in an 8-1 decision. But today, exactly 50 years later, youthful defendants still face challenges in the North Carolina court system. Ours is the only state in the nation that still tries and incarcerates convicted 16 and 17-year-olds as adults. Most are found guilty of nonviolent offenses like disturbing the peace, school fights, and petty theft. But because they are tried as adults, their convictions mean they are branded for life, inhibiting their ability to get or hold jobs and setting them on a negative trajectory through life. We observe today's 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision in the Gault case by using it as a backdrop for a discussion about the nature of juvenile justice here. We're joined by Bob Simmons, Executive Director of the Council for Children's Rights, which provides legal representation and advocacy for individual children. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Good to see you. He's in our Spirit Square studio, along with Mujtaba Muhammad, Assistant Public Defender for Mecklenburg County. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
And Judge Elizabeth Thornton Trosh is a district court judge here in Charlotte. Thank you for joining us, too.
Good morning. Thank you.
Let's go back to that landmark Supreme Court decision of 50 years ago today. It gave juveniles in the justice system the same due process rights as adults. What was the situation prior to that decision, and why were children essentially, as a result of this, in greater jeopardy than adults when they faced a judge and jury? Who wants to take that?
Well, Mike, I'll start. The situation at that time was that children were just not accorded those rights. They didn't have notice of their charges. They didn't have right to counsel. They didn't have the protections that adults would expect that they would receive when they're accused of a crime and brought into the system. So they didn't have the ability to defend themselves or to protect themselves from the imposition by the state of sanctions.
That sounds very Dickensian, and this is America. So why was that allowed to happen? Why, obviously, that was just the way people thought about things, but why?
Well, I feel like the courts took a very paternalistic approach. There was no type of formal type of hearing. Like Bob mentioned in the case of Gerald Gault, mm-hmm. No notice. They just came and picked him up from home. His parents didn't even know that he was picked up and taken into custody into a detention home. If you look at the facts of the case, the witness that allegedly made the comments that he had made lewd comments to her wasn't even there.
Yeah.
No confrontation, nothing. And the judge actually took time and said, hey, we'll think about it, sent Jerry Gault back to the detention home where an informal letter was sent to his house to come back to a hearing. That's where he decided, that he's going to send him to a detention center for till 21.
This child, he was, I think, what, 15 years old
15
at
years
the
old.
Time. Gerald Francis Gault, 15, taken into custody for allegedly making an obscene phone call. He'd previously been on probation for being in the company of a boy who stole a wallet, I believe, from a woman's purse. And at the time of his arrest, the police did not leave notice with Gault's parents. How unusual was that for the parents not to be notified that their child had been arrested? Not unusual for the time?
Well, at the time, I guess, because the way we looked at children as if they didn't have rights, as if they weren't human beings, as if they didn't have legal rights, and parents and the elders will just make decisions for them. Mm. That's the way it went about.
So in 2008, Gerald Gault actually made an appearance at Georgetown Law School, and he described his arrest and processing this way.
Whenever they picked me up, it was early in the morning because I was getting ready to go to my very first job. From the time I got there till the time I got into the actual juvenile detention center, I got no water, no food, and there was no bathroom facilities in there. I mean, there was nothing in there but a steel door and concrete bunks.
Now, his parents eventually found out that he was arrested. They came home from work. He wasn't at home. They sent his older brother, I think, out to look for him. And somehow, through a third party, they eventually found out that he had been arrested. And then when his mother arrived at the detention home, she was informed that a hearing was scheduled for the next day. They didn't attend. The parents didn't attend for whatever reasons, and no records were kept of what happened in that hearing. He was later released. His case was scheduled for another hearing in June of 1964. Again, no records were kept. And he says he believed that hearing would merely be a formality.
He's going to tell me what I did wrong, and he's going to slap me on the fingers and send me home with my mother and father. Well, he decided that I was a juvenile delinquent and that my parents weren't doing a job raising me, which was a lie, that I was going to the state reform school until I was 21 years old. If I would have been tried as an adult, which they didn't do then either, I would have only gotten a $30 fine or 30 days in jail. I got 6 years. My mother asked the judge if she could kiss me goodbye. He told her, no, you don't deserve that right. My father stood up and said, this is bullshit. And believe it or not, I got to see my mother, but the only thing I saw my dad was his back going outside. And he was not happy. I found out eventually that he went to an attorney right straight from there.
And that was a fortuitous trip, because evidently that was the beginning of the journey to the Supreme Court, where on this day, 50 years ago, they decided that the proceedings of the juvenile court failed to comply with the Constitution. The Constitution was nearly 200 years old by then. What took 200 years for them to decide that children being not treated equally to adults with due process was unfair and unconstitutional? Judge. You're the judge here.
I don't know that I have an answer to the question of why it took 200 years. I think that what we've seen even since Galt is continuing evolving understanding of children and their development, and evolving understanding of how we can respond more effectively to their needs when they commit delinquent acts in the community.
What was it about this case? Was it simply that his father was not going to stand for it and pursued it to the Supreme Court, or people got involved in the legal system who also thought, well, this is wrong, so we'll take this, we'll help you get a decision? Why didn't this happen before? Why was it him? Anybody know the answer to that?
Well, I think that, Mike, if you look at a lot of the cases that the Supreme Court has decided over the years where rights have been expanded, you'll see that a lot of it just has to do with timing. Mm-hmm. It has to do with who is on the court at the time. It depends on who the potential plaintiff is and whether they have the resources and the both financial and personal to stick it out through a case that starts at a local level and works its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. Those things take a lot of time and a lot of effort, and it's hard to get people to do that. So I think that a lot of it has to do with timing. And I think, as Elizabeth said, you know, the development over time of information about the way children develop, the way their brains develop, right, the way they should be treated, that has evolved as well. I was talking to Lou Anne earlier this morning. I have a copy in my office of the Laws and Liberties of Massachusetts from 1648, where disrespecting parents was punishable by death. So, you know, the way we have treated our children over the years has evolved seriously since that point. But, you know, it takes those moments when we understand humanity better.
Gotta love those Puritans, don't you? He mentioned that had he been an adult, he would have gotten a $50 fine and 2 months in jail. Instead, he got 6 years in juvenile detention. And we're going to talk a lot today about trying children as children in juvenile court and not in adult court, because North Carolina is the only state that still tries 16- and 17-year-olds as adults. But his situation makes it almost sound better that he would have been tried in an adult court. He would have gotten a lesser sentence. Is that sometimes still the case in North Carolina?
I mean, if you look at juvenile courts, the way they are, Mike, the way they're set up, oftentimes people get them confused and think that they're like in teen court. But juvenile courts are pretty – they hold people pretty accountable.
Mm-hmm.
Children are locked up and put into detention centers. Parents can be held in contempt for not showing up to those hearings. The very serious matters – now, as an assistant public defender that represents 16 and 17-year-olds in the adult criminal justice system, for some of the similar charges that a 16-year-old might pick up in North Carolina even today in juvenile court, he'll more likely have a much more – of a treatment and support system based at the same time could be punitive as compared to the adult criminal justice system where it might be a simple fine or unsupervised probation.
Hmm. Why? Why do we take a different approach?
Well, children are works in progress. So we recognize that when a young person commits certain acts that would be crimes if they were committed as an adult, that we have a responsibility to provide resources and an opportunity to habilitate or rehabilitate that child.
The Galt case was the beginning of children's rights in courtrooms, et cetera, because there have been other decisions that have come since then that have either clarified or extended the rights of young people in the court system. Does that strengthen the argument in North Carolina against trying 16 and 17-year-olds as adults?
I think the United States Supreme Court, over a series of decisions related to both whether a child's age is a consideration and whether they are have received their Miranda rights and are willingly and knowingly waiving those rights in a police interrogation, decisions that have concluded that it is a cruel and unusual punishment to subject a child, a person under 18, to the penalty of death for certain crimes, and that life without parole is also cruel and unusual punishment for a person under the age of 18, have given a pretty clear signal to courts across the country that children are different,
mm-hmm.
and we need to understand that they are works in progress, their brains are developing, and that means that their ability to understand and appreciate the decisions that they've made, the proceedings that they're a part of, is limited.
Well, the three of you are clearly going to be advocates of lowering the age, putting 16 and 17-year-olds on trial in juvenile as opposed to adult court. We know that. But are there people, how many people disagree with you, and what's their reasoning for that?
I'll tell you, as far as North Carolina, and I'll commend at least our state legislature in the state house. It's been a pretty bipartisan effort here in North Carolina, with both the Democrats and Republicans coming in support for raising the age of 16 and 17-year-olds. It's my understanding that the Conference of DAs is a little hesitant to raise the age right now. Their biggest issue is transferring those felonies in general, serious and violent felonies, having that capability to do that on their own, as opposed to right now where we have Judge Trash here today. Right now in juvenile court, if you are charged with a felony and you're 13 or older, what will happen is the state must show probable cause, and the judge will then see if this child's capable to transfer to the adult superior court system.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about the possible raising of the age to 18 for young people being tried in courtrooms as opposed to juvenile court when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Taylor Richards & Conger, the specialty shop for men built and headquartered in Charlotte's Phillips Place, featuring European and American tailored and made-to-measure clothing and accessories. Details at trcstyle.com. And Carolina Pest Management, protecting homes and families since 1939, offering environmentally responsible Centricon termite colony elimination system plus other green pest, mosquito, and moisture control services. CarolinaPest.com. 13 Reasons Why, the Netflix series, has raised concerns in the mental health community over its portrayal of suicide. They also object to the main characters assigning blame on people she perceives as having wronged her. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for teens, and experts fear the show could lead to copycats. So we'll take a look at the controversy, at whether it crosses the line, and how parents can discuss suicide and mental health with children tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Republican Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska speaks his mind. He has plenty to say about President Trump, James Comey, Washington politics, even how we're raising our children. He's with us. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
You can join On Point right after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the juvenile court system in Charlotte on this 50th anniversary to the day of a Supreme Court decision that gave due process rights to children for the first time, constitutionally guaranteed due process rights to children for the first time in the United States. Elizabeth Thornton Trosh is here. She's a district court judge in Charlotte. Mushtaba Muhammad is an assistant public defender from Mecklenburg County. And Bob Simmons is executive director for the Council for Children's Rights. As I said at the very beginning, North Carolina is the only state out of 50 that still tries 16- and 17-year-old juveniles in adult court and sentences them to adult prisons. Why? What has taken North Carolina so long to change its mind about this, when other states, including Mississippi and Alabama, have beaten us to the punch? Bob.
Well, Mike, I think, and going back to what Mushtaba was talking about before the break, I think that there are people who still look at children and look at the delivery of consequences for misbehavior in much the same way that they did in Massachusetts in 1648. They're looking at a punishment-based model that doesn't take into consideration the brain development of children or the ability to rehabilitate and to incorporate children in a better way into society. So I think that they look at it as being hard on crime rather than soft on crime.
We have portrayed ourselves in the past or have been considered by many outside the state to be the progressive southern state, and yet you have Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Florida, Texas, all of them, every single state in the union except us, not taking this trajectory.
You know, Bob just mentioned about the differences between harder on crime. Mm-hmm. And it's really about being smart on crime. Raising the age in North Carolina is really a no-brainer, Mike. It lowers recidivism rates. Studies show that. It's a public safety issue, right? If people are concerned about their own safety, their personal safety, mm-hmm. having kids, 16, 17-year-olds, involved in the juvenile justice system as opposed to the adult criminal justice system, where they're going to get record, where they're going to have a collateral consequence as far as finding jobs, housing, those things will all impact them negatively. There's a study out from Princeton and Princeton University that shows for every dollar spent mm-hmm. on juvenile delinquency programs to reduce recidivism, it's taxpayers in those states save $7 to $10. $7 to $10.
No one will answer my question as to why we're so late in coming to the table on this. And maybe it's a political thing and you're trying to tap dance around the politics, but Judge, you're not a politician. So why have we been late to the table on this? Why are we the last state to consider doing this and we haven't done it yet?
Well, I think that Mr. Muhammad got at the issue. A big part of it is a belief that if we transfer responsibility for prosecuting 16 and 17-year-olds who've committed delinquent acts to the juvenile court, that somehow that is going to result in lower accountability.
Well, what has happened in other states that have beat us to the punch? What's happened there?
I think that, their legislatures have been persuaded by the evidence that they will save money, that there are lower rates of recidivism for kids who are handled in juvenile court versus prosecuted as adults. And I think a big part of it has to do, frankly, with being prepared to make the investment that the state is going to have to make in order to carry this out.
Have there been negative aspects to taking this course in the states that have already done it? Has there been any fallout?
Number of states, as far as cost, I honestly think, Mike, the question is we have to ask ourselves, are we going to prioritize our children and our community? Mm-hmm. And sadly, it looks like for a number of years in North Carolina, we were writing off our children, writing off kids in our community. And now that conversation is picking back up. We said 50 years of the Gault case today.
Right.
That conversation is finally picking up. And now North Carolina, sadly, being that last state, hopefully we're looking at ourselves and saying, hey, this is the right thing to do. This is going to be cost savings. If you're a kid in South Carolina or Georgia and you commit that same misdemeanor charge, you're going to be treated completely differently than compared to North Carolina. Why should those children in other states get those same advantages that the kids in North Carolina are not getting? It's a simple question, right?
Right.
And it makes no sense why our legislature hasn't done it yet, and hopefully they will.
We're going to talk about the costs of doing what we do the way we do it in a little while, and you alluded to that a second ago, Mushtaba. But Judge Trosh, you talked about the investment that we have to make in order to do this. What kind of investment?
Well, we have looked locally at what the impact of implementation of the Raise the Age legislation would be, and we would have to reallocate and possibly even have additional resources for our courts to be able to have adequate juvenile court sessions in order to hear these cases in juvenile court. The district attorney's office would require additional staff. The Council for Children's Rights, we would need additional defenders. And then juvenile justice would need additional staff in order to supervise these kids.
Is that because the majority of juvenile crimes are committed by older juveniles and not younger juveniles?
No, it's just that when you're looking at pulling in 16 and 17-year-olds into the juvenile system, most delinquent acts are committed by kids between the ages of 13 and 15 currently in the juvenile system, and then 16 and 17. And the vast majority of those criminal acts are minor misdemeanor offenses. A small percentage are nonviolent felonies, and transferring that workload over to our juvenile justice system is going to require reallocation and probably an investment of additional resources.
When you're 16 or 17, you can't vote. You can't enter into a contract without your parents' permission. I'm not even sure you can with their permission. You can't drink. You can't sign up to serve in the military. So what case does the other side make for trying these young people in adult courts? If you can't have any of those rights, why would you be considered an adult?
I think that part of the reason is the misperception that prosecuting people for criminal acts in adult court is more punitive and a more effective response. And there's a misapprehension about how these systems work. A young person who is charged with a minor offense who's prosecuted in juvenile court is actually going to have, frankly, more supervision, more intervention, and an experience that prosecution, I think, is more onerous than they would prosecuted in adult court, where it's honestly a little confusing. The right to counsel is not available for a lot of the minor offenses that this population would be committing or in court for. And then they don't fully appreciate the collateral consequences. You go in, oh, okay, I did that. I pay a fine or court costs, and that's not really a big deal. It doesn't deter the behavior. It doesn't address any underlying issues that are contributing to the behavior. And then now I have a criminal record. I am no longer eligible for financial aid when I'm ready to apply for college, and so on and so forth. So part of it is truly, I think, a misapprehension of the relative severity of the interventions in adult court versus juvenile court.
You wrote a blog, Bob, in which you repeated a comment that you heard from someone at a banquet. And it's a comment that some of our listeners might be making right now as they yell at the radio, who don't agree with this idea of raising the age of juvenile rights. The comment was, children don't have rights. Their parents have the responsibility to care for them. Obviously, you disagree. Why?
Well, I disagree because I think that's an oversimplification of the concept. Yes, parents have responsibilities, and our system recognizes that parents have responsibilities. That it also recognizes that they have authority. But the children themselves, as human beings, do have rights. And the Supreme Court decided that in Ray Gault, and it has decided that over and over again since then. So I understand where people would be coming from with this, because they think that the individual family unit is the primary organizing system for the bearing and raising of children. Mm-hmm. And I think that our system actually still supports that. And actually the juvenile court system is a better representation of that belief.
Why?
Than the adult system. Because as Judge Trosh said, and I think that Mujtaba said it as well, the juvenile system involves the entire family in the solution to the problem. Instead of singly holding the child responsible, it holds the parents responsible. Unlike adult court, where the judge cannot force the parents to come in to court in connection with their child's offense, the juvenile court judge has that power. Parents can be held in contempt for not appearing in the hearings of their children. So in many ways, when you're responding to that kind of idea in the community, I think it's important, as Judge Trosh said, to be sure that they understand the way the system works and to understand that families, as families, are held accountable for the misbehavior of children in juvenile court.
So are the three of you and those who agree with you arguing for more rights for children in the courts, for different rights in the courts than adults have, or for simply equal rights in the courtroom?
I think it's a mixture, Mike. I think that what we're really asking for is that there is a baseline of constitutional rights that every person in this country has, and that's where Galt went. The Fifth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, they apply to children as well. But it's those rights plus in juvenile court. Children, because of their incapacity and the development of their brains, require additional rights. They require, for example, in JDB versus North Carolina, which went to the Supreme Court, there was a discussion about whether a child could be interrogated the way Jerry Galt was by himself under terrible circumstances where there was no adult present. Can you do that to a child and then actually believe that they have knowingly waived their Miranda rights or that their confession is voluntary? So what we're really looking at is those basic rights plus a recognition of children's incapacity that protects them even more fully.
Because that decision in the Galt case was 50 years ago today, but you all of you say that there's still a long way to go in the juvenile court system, not only here but around the country. You say that due to inconsistent enforcement and the lack of awareness, the due process rights of children in delinquency court are not always protected. But why not? The Supreme Court made that decision 50 years ago. Nobody wants to jump in on that?
Well, I think that, again, this is one of those things, Mike, a lot of it may have to do with resources. For example, in Mecklenburg County, we have both a long history of a more progressive court system mm-hmm. at all levels than in many other parts of the state. And one of the things that we have in Mecklenburg County is also the Council for Children's Rights. We are the only organization like ours in the state that provides dedicated juvenile defenders to children who are in juvenile court, who have been trained in juvenile law. In all of the other 99 counties, juveniles are represented by people off of a court-appointed list who may or may not have a real experience in juvenile law, and they're paid $55 an hour to do that work. So if you look at those situations around North Carolina and in other parts of the country, the resources have not been dedicated mm-hmm. to the delivery of effective juvenile defense, regardless of what Galt decided. It's an ongoing process.
Even though all 49 other states now try 16 and 17-year-olds in juvenile courts, not adult courts, you say that 31 of these states have no laws saying how young is too young to prosecute a child. What is the youngest age at which children have been prosecuted in this country?
I'm not sure about in the country, but I know in North Carolina specifically that age is starts at 6 years old.
6 years old?
6 years old. 6 years old.
What do they prosecute them for? What
crime have they committed? Thankfully, I've never had a six-year-old client that I've ever had to represent. I don't know if Judge Trosh has seen a six-year-old in there.
I think the youngest I've seen was 10. I think, fortunately, locally, our chief court counselor recognizes that when a child as young as six does something like takes maybe a knife to school in their lunchbox or, you know, hits a classmate or
steals candy from the corner store,
damages property in the desk or something in the classroom, that this is a young person, that there are other responses that are developmentally appropriate that don't warrant the an involvement in a court proceeding. But in North Carolina, 6 is the minimum age at which a child can be referred into the juvenile justice system.
And in North Carolina, since you're all from North Carolina, what's the most serious crime that you've seen committed by young people, either under the age of 16 because they're tried in adult courts currently, or from 16 to 17? What's the worst thing that they've done?
Well, murder.
I mean, yeah. Okay. I mean, the crimes, I mean, like I said, like Bob mentioned, children are different. Science shows that right. mind doesn't develop right. till they're at least 25. So there's a vast array of different types of crimes that young people can commit. But the data shows the reality is that the 80% of those crimes, especially in North Carolina, are minor misdemeanors, right? And a very low percentage are those serious. And almost 3.3% make up those violent felonies. And those violent felonies are murder, robbery with a dangerous weapon, serious sexual offenses. So that's what's going on.
33 states do not allow jury trials in juvenile court. Why? Why isn't that a violation of due process? Aren't we guaranteed a trial by a jury of our peers? And who would those peers be? Other 15-year-olds? But why aren't they given jury trials in these 31 states? And do we give them here?
We do not.
Why not?
I don't have an answer to that question, except that I would say that probably there's some belief that a judge trained in the law and who also may have some training and education around kids and brain development and all of those kinds of things is better suited to adjudicate these cases. We also prioritize swift adjudications and dispositions in juvenile court. We really try to move these proceedings along as quickly as possible so that that young person is held accountable at the earliest possible stage so that interventions are delivered when they can be most effective. And I think those are probably some of the considerations.
I will say, as far as in juvenile court, one of the biggest concerns is privacy, protecting the children's identity, the family's identity, and not scarring them. Mm-hmm. With that, and then with the working in both the juvenile justice system previously and now the adult criminal justice system is much more adversarial, mm-hmm. right? You got the state, you got defense attorneys, but the juvenile justice system takes more of a team approach, working with prosecutors, working with the child's attorney, court counselors, which are kind of like probation officers, and judges, much more of a team effort. Why? To preserve and help that kid and reduce recidivism rates, which is why they need to be in juvenile court.
Of the million American children charged in this country each year with crimes, most, as you've said several times, are prosecuted for nonviolent offenses. Is that why only 42% have an attorney? Or is it because in some counties, up to 80% of the children are denied their constitutional rights to an attorney?
Again, I think I would go back to the question of whether the mandate of Galt from 50 years ago has been implemented across the country in every jurisdiction as a result of the movement of the right and the allocation of resources to it. Many places just don't have the resources to provide a young person with an attorney in their local jurisdiction.
Wow. Bob Simmons is Executive Director for the Council for Children's Rights. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NC Warn, working to slow climate change by curbing methane emissions from the fracked gas and power industries. Information on clean energy alternatives at ncwarn.org. And the Iron Yard, offering full and part-time web development courses in Charlotte for career development. Enrollment is open. More info at theironyard.com/Charlotte. Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse says the country is facing a crisis of public trust following the firing of FBI Director James Comey. The Republican lawmaker and former university president is also concerned about what he calls a crisis of perpetual adolescence among America's youth. It's the focus of his new book, The Vanishing American Adult, and he will join guest host Jane Clayson on Point in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock.
All Things Considered on WFAE helps you go beneath the surface of the day's news.
It's dipped to 4.4%. And Andrew, that rate hasn't been that low in a while, but what does it actually mean?
May 2007 was the last time we had a 4.4%.
There's more to every story. Listen weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 for All Things Considered from NPR News and 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the juvenile justice system. North Carolina is the only state in the union that still tries 16 and 17-year-olds in adult courts and sends them to adult jails when they are convicted and actually while they're awaiting trial. Although there is a bill in the legislature that may change all of that. And we're talking about this on the 50th anniversary of decision by the Supreme Court that gave children constitutional rights to due process in the courtrooms. Bob Simmons is here. He's executive director for the Council for Children's Rights. Mushtaba Muhammad, assistant public defender from Mecklenburg County, and Judge Elizabeth Thornton Trush, a district court judge here in Charlotte. What is the purpose of, as you see it, of the juvenile justice system? Is it to punish? Is it to change behavior and reform behavior? What is it now and what should it be?
Judge. I think that the purpose is to promote public safety by holding young people accountable and providing rehabilitative services in order to prepare that young person to the extent that it's possible to reintegrate into our communities and become productive contributing citizens.
There is, it seems, a racial component to how all this works, and an ethnic one as well, as there is to so many things in our society. You report that youthful black offenders are 2.3 times more likely than whites to be referred to law enforcement in school. Latinos caught in juvenile court are 41% more likely to receive out-of-home placement than their white peers, and LGBTQ youth make up 7% of the overall population, but 20% of young people in the juvenile justice system. Why?
Well, Mike, I think that this actually may be in part the answer that you were looking for to your question earlier about why North Carolina is last in the country. Because of this disproportionality in the engagement of minority youth in the criminal justice system, and because of the disparate outcomes that that produces, I think that people in this state are more likely to look at children who are arrested for whatever reason as more dangerous, perhaps, than they are, and to be more likely to encourage the treatment of them as somebody who is dangerous and must be removed from the community rather than reintegrated into the community, which is an important part of the juvenile justice system. So I think, you know, your question now may have raised the issue that has made us last, which is, and I think I've heard this expression before, that people look at these children as monsters. They don't look at them as children.
Hmm. But other states, other southern states, other conservative states in the Midwest, for instance, have taken a different tact earlier than we have. I just find that amazing. We're never going to get an answer to that question, so I'm going to stop asking it. But it's astounding to me. The Council for Children's Rights, Bob Simmons, has a statement of principles, fundamental beliefs, and commitments to juvenile justice, which include the proposition that every child be provided a juvenile defense attorney. And we talked a minute ago about how sometimes that is not the case because there simply aren't the resources for that. But this attorney would represent them in all stages of the time they're dealing with the juvenile justice system and would be available through public funding. What kind of reaction has this proposal received here or elsewhere in the country?
Well, as I said before, I think that we are unique in this state. We actually do receive funding from the state to be the public defender for juveniles in juvenile court. We are the only group like that in North Carolina. We are very rare, actually, across the United States. And it is very important for the person who is defending a child in juvenile court to understand juvenile law. But we also go behind that, Mike. The difference between what we do and what a lawyer who comes off of the appointed list will do is that we have social workers in our organization. So we look not only at the immediate legal problem that the child is facing, but we look at their life, at their family, at their school to try to figure out what can we do as a system and what can we propose to the court that will result in a disposition of this child's case that results in improvement, a better outcome?
Couldn't it be argued that it's more important to have an adult representing a child in the courtroom than it is to have an adult representing an adult in the courtroom. Because an adult, theoretically speaking, would have some basic legal knowledge of their rights.
Which is why in juvenile court you have much more of a team effort, mm-hmm. right? Bob just mentioned the social workers are there, different type of treatment providers. The parents have to be involved. It's a team effort. But the, one of the important things in Galt, the case talks about the guiding hand of counsel. Mm-hmm. Being a juvenile attorney who's represented children, the reality is sometimes even parents can cause conflicts when representing children. So that's why it's so important to look at that, the expressed interest of that child, and represent him to meet his needs and make sure his needs are also being met in that matter. And that's what attorneys do. It's very vastly different from the adult criminal justice system. In the adult criminal justice system, if you look at attorneys, you have to first find that they're indigent to even be appointed counsel. North Carolina, thankfully, following Galt case, there's automatic presumption of indigence for juveniles.
Let's go back to that case, the landmark Jerry Galt case in 1967 with the decision on this day 50 years ago in 1968 for the Supreme Court. Here again is Jerry Galt speaking at Georgetown University Law School a few years ago about his reaction to the Supreme Court decision in his favor.
It was exhilarating, but yet it was a relief. You know, I'd already gotten on, tried to get on with my life, you know, and now that this was happening, now I could get on with my life. Maybe now I could get a job, keep a job, you know, that, because if I got a job the minute they found out that I was in the reform school, I was gone.
He brings up a problem faced by nearly all people who have ever been convicted of a serious crime, adult or child, how a conviction and a jail sentence affects your life forever. For juvenile offenders, do their convictions impede their path through life? Are you always marked? You mentioned earlier, Judge Trosh, that you in some cases you can't get a student loan, therefore you can't go to college if you can't afford to pay yourself. Some colleges won't accept you because you have a criminal record. It's very difficult to become hired. You cannot enroll in, or you can't get federal housing because they won't let you in. You can't probably join the military. I mean, what can you do? You become a criminal.
Well, I think that that's the point, that for 16- and 17-year-olds who do certain things that developmentally, the decision-making isn't any more improved at 16 and 17 than it is at 14 and 15, the consequences are substantial. Mm-hmm. Whereas in juvenile court, the proceedings are confidential. The records are not disclosable. This is not a criminal record that will follow that young person into their future.
Because Ben David, who is the new Hanover County District Attorney, says that putting children through the adult system sets them on a trajectory through a life of despair and a revolving door to the criminal justice system. How many district attorneys and members of the court and members of the legislature that are considering this bill, how many of them recognize this?
I mean, in speaking with D.A. Murray, previously sat on a Raise the Age panel with him, I'm sure the D.A.'s conference understands that. But again, their concerns, their primary concerns from my understanding and from folks in the legislature is cost. Again, writing our young people off just for cause. And my thing is, if since 2013, the state of North Carolina, we've lost almost $3 billion a year in revenue due to tax breaks to big corporations and the wealthy, there's money out there. And other states have seen money saved, $7 to $10, like I told you, on the dollar.
But those are tax breaks for good people. That's what the argument would be.
But that's my point. We've got to prioritize our children. Other states are doing it. We need to do that. We need to get the DA's offices more attorneys to represent.
So what is the cost of trying 16- and 17-year-olds in adult courts, having their records be criminal records, not sealed and not hidden from the public, that follow them through life, and putting them in adult jails and letting them out in some cases in some point in time? What is the cost of that?
Millions and millions of dollars or more, because you're looking at arresting people, you're looking at the prosecution of people, and then you're looking at incarceration. Incarceration is millions and millions of dollars when we could be spending that same money on 16, 17-year-olds, helping them families, realizing their weaknesses, and helping them become better members of our society.
So we are the last of 49 states to make this move, and we still haven't made it, although there is a bill in the legislature being considered right now to raise the age to 18 and putting the 16 and 17-year-olds in juvenile court. In the other 49 states where this has already occurred, what have the savings been? What have the cost differentials been? Do we know?
Well, there was a study in 2011 that was oriented actually toward North Carolina. It was a Vera Institute, if I'm remembering it right. And I think that the savings that they were looking at was $52.3 million a year, if I'm remembering that correctly.
You are.
That is consistent with what happened in Illinois. It's consistent with what has happened in Connecticut. And those two states are probably the leaders in the advancement of this concept. Connecticut is actually considering raising the age to 21, the age for adult criminal culpability, because they have seen the benefit in their state of treating young people as young people.
Well, again, in many states, and I think it's this one too, you can't drink until you're 21. Why would you be considered an adult? If you're an adult to the criminal justice system, why can't you have a drink?
Well, you know, one thing I thought of when you raised that question is the fact that in civil law, in any civil proceeding, a person under the age of 18 is presumptively incompetent and incapable of representing their own interests in that civil case, whether it's a lawsuit about a car accident, you know, or even in domestic violence protective order proceedings. You're presumptively incompetent in civil proceedings and require the appointment of an adult to kind of stand in your shoes and use their adult brain to make decisions for you. So it is irrational.
Let me share with you some things that have come in while we've been talking. Jamie in Charlotte, I'm a teacher in my planning period. I just heard you say that parents can be charged if they don't show up. I wish we could talk about solutions when students are out of control or dangerous in school. A not so well-known fact is that in high poverty schools, parents block the school phone numbers and no-show consistently. I think that's why these kids end up arrested, because the schools do not have the staff to discipline these out-of-control students with parents that offer zero help. You have a comment on that?
I mean, that, again, that's the point of the whole juvenile justice system. I've said time and again, it's a treatment-based approach. It's a family system. It's a team approach. And having young people in the juvenile justice system is obviously going to be much more beneficial to teachers, to schools, to our community as a whole in general. The Opportunity Task Force, one of their recommendations is raising the juvenile age. It's going to benefit our community as a whole.
And I think that another thing to keep in mind is that what we see when these families come into our court is that a lot of times families are stressed. They're experiencing socioeconomic stress. They're experiencing emotional stress associated with living in low-resource communities and oftentimes raising children on their own. When they come into juvenile court, we can hold parents accountable, and we're also in a position to provide resources and support to increase that parent's capacity to support their child in their rehabilitative process.
We did talk a second about the ethnic and racial component to some of the outcomes and also how these children are treated before they ever get to court. Tom asks, the child of a millionaire is not going to adult prison. Black, Hispanic, or poor whites are guilty before they get to court. Would you agree with that? Or is that too strong?
If you look at the data right now, African-American children are much more likely to be in the criminal justice system, in the juvenile justice system. If you look at white children, they're being served in the mental health system. So we have a punitive measure for children of color, and we take a mental health services approach to white children. The data is clear. It's out there for people to see.
97%, I think one of you said this earlier today, 97% of juvenile offenders commit nonviolent offenses, but that leaves the other 3% who are involved in violent crime. How should they be treated by the juvenile justice system?
We do have young people in our juvenile justice system who have committed violent crimes. And our statute, one, provides the prosecutor with the discretion to recommend transfer to Superior Court for prosecution as an adult, but also sets forth certain criteria for the court to consider in determining whether that is a disposition that is in the interest of the public and the child, and really looks at issues around public safety, culpability, whether rehabilitative efforts would likely be successful. And there are circumstances when the juvenile justice system is able to offer resources that are going to put that person on or have a greater probability of putting that person on a path to reintegrating into the community safely. Whereas in the adult system, just locking a kid away for 5, 10, 15, 20 years in prison will just produce someone who is no better and probably worse for the wear.
How would these violent offenders be treated if the Juvenile Justice Reinvestment Act, which is going through the legislature now, goes through and is passed and signed into law? How would it change?
The statute that's been proposed, HB 280 in the House, would separate the top five levels of felonies from the structure that Judge Trosh just described. Under the new statute, those young people, 16 and 17 years old, would be transferred automatically to adult court on the finding of probable cause or on the issuing of an indictment. This is something that the prosecutors, in particular the district attorneys, wanted to be able to control that process. So they will be treated differently for that purpose.
The law that we're operating under now that allows 16 and 17-year-olds to be tried as adults was adopted in 1919. So what chance do you see for this new law to be adopted?
I think the chances are very good. Last week, it came out of the Judiciary Committee unanimously in the House. It then was approved by appropriations. There are enough sponsors on the bill to pass it without anybody else joining.
Bob Simmons gets the last word. He's executive director of the Council for Children's Rights. Mushtaba Muhammad is assistant public defender in Mecklenburg County. And Elizabeth Thornton Trosh is a district court judge here. Thank you all for the hour.